So if I could hear if you have any request for some aspect of the Dhamma that you've heard, from one of the lists, or some question in your life that you would want to hear how it might be looked at from a Dharma perspective. No politics, please. Nothing to do with that, but about your life. And
our Dharma group was talking about the term of the deathless, and we were reading about how they said that the deathless in Nirvana, and that how Arahant has to die, no Nirvana, and then somebody said no, that they don't. We're just like, what, like, how Nirvana and the deathless, and what the deathless is. And we had about a half hour discussion, and I came up with, I don't know.
That's a very good starting place. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, you said something last week that left a question mark for me. It was something like this, correct me if I'm wrong, but we visit the same wounds over time.
Yes.
But only if we deepen our experience each time. If we don't deepen our experience each time, we don't revisit them. Is that accurate?
Yes, and that was not clear enough, so thank you for giving me another opportunity. Because there was a definite context for that.
Any thoughts you might have on bringing kindness to yourself as you practice when you're having difficulty doing so?
This may tie in with this gentleman asked for, but I've been practicing a long time now, not as deeply as I should have, but enough to make me somewhat happy. I would like to hear what you have to say about Buddhism as a developmental path. Does that make sense? No.
Mm-hmm.
The individual development.
Okay, one more. If there is one, no, there's two. I'll just do them both. Go ahead.
I'd like to hear you say something about not valuing one thing over another.
And is there a context that you've heard that?
Yes, and I can't remember the full context, but eventually it comes so that we don't prefer one thing over another, we don't have the bane of the likes and the dislikes. It has to do with non-judgmentalism, and I think eventually pursuing it to nothingness, to that still point.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Letting go of the conceptual mind.
Letting go of the conceptual mind. So when we are in our meditation practice or the same in daily life, but so often in a sitting, we come across one of our wounds, something that's not healed in us, something that is very difficult. When I say not healed, we can also come across old wounds that are there, but they're no longer a major factor in our lives. They may be a minor factor, but not a major factor. In those instances, over time, I wanted to change gears. You know, it seems like I was being wound out too much, and I needed a release. Yes, trying too hard. So we can. Wow, that isn't persistent. So, for the purpose of the tape, we were listening to a motor going along the highway. So we can have when we've integrated the experience of the wound to a certain degree, that among other things means we're not demanding that it be other ways. That this happened, it was like this, and we've not forsaken necessarily the wrongness of what happened to us, if there was a real wrongness or a real mistake we made, and we got wounded by what we did to ourselves. But we ceased to demand that it had been otherwise. That's one of the stages of maturity, that we're at ease with the way it was. We're not demanding a better past or a different past, if that's more acceptable to you. And so there's the wound becomes available for a deeper understanding, an identifying with the nature of this realm, which has a kind of wounding aspect to it. You know, does anyone make it through childhood without some kind of wound? Maybe, but boy, that would be few. And does anyone make it through adulthood without a wound? Hard to imagine. If nothing else, that we are wounded by seeing those we love being wounded. It's wounding in that way, if nothing else. So even when a wound is, when something that has really been hard for us has been worked at, there's still a richness there, but it's not the same. It becomes an asset more than something that is a burden to us. What often happens, and this is the clarity I did not provide last week, what often happens at a certain level of understanding, at a certain level of being raw with ourselves, being real with ourselves, we work the wound out at that level of depth of our experience. If we don't, then as we move through time, it just keeps popping up at that same depth of experience. So anytime we touch that level, we've touched, and it can be almost every day in some instances, that same old wound is going on affecting us. Does that make sense to you? As we progress in our practice, that level of the wound often has a tendency to get understood, released, met with compassion, met with metta. We develop our upekkha, our equanimity, so that it doesn't fire at that level anymore. And we go, wow, through my therapy, through my dharma practice, through being with friends, through growing in experience, I've taken care of that. Whew, I'm so grateful I took care of that. And we get a little confident about that. And then so time goes on, and as time goes on, we drop down to deeper understanding, deeper level, where we're more vulnerable in a way, to we're just more sensitive, we're more a different level of psyche, if you like. And out of nowhere, there's that wound again that we had such a feeling that we'd taken care of it. Yay for me, I took care of that. And now here it is again. And people will come in on retreat saying, I know I'd taken care of this. Really, the therapy, this work, whatever their story is about it, I'd taken care of that. It has not been a factor in me all of this time. Why is it now a factor again? What I was explaining is that that at a level of being, the wound doesn't move across our level of being. It doesn't cut straight across. When we are cut by something, it's cut at an angle deeper and deeper into our psyche. And so as we drop down to a deeper level of psyche, at this level, we've taken care of the wound. But when we drop down to this level, there it is again. But it's not the same wound exactly, although it had the same origins. It's got somewhat different characteristics at a deeper level. And it's to be addressed yet again. And there's new opportunity for understanding, for levels of manifestation of the Brahma Viharas at this new level around that wound. When it becomes an asset, it's a whole much larger asset, as it were, in terms of its subtlety. So that is the role that, from my experience, you know, this is not from the Buddha's mouth to my ear. It is my experience of having worked with, you know, so many people now over so many decades and so forth, that this is the way wounding works. And I find that reassuring at first in my own life, things I thought I'd taken care of, and then they showed back up, and I'm going, what is this? And then seeing it in so many other people, at first I was going, well, that's discouraging. But then as I stayed with it longer, I realized that it actually represented a more total experience of my being liberated from clinging, from demanding. And so that is the way I hold this now. And it is only our attachment or our sense of identity around what we've taken care of that can make it such a difficult thing. If we go, oh, here's an opportunity to work with it at a more subtle level, then we're actually eager in a certain way. We'd rather that it was all taken care of, because some wounds don't go that deep, but some go way deep through many levels of being. It just depends on the nature of what happened to you around a particular thing. And so that's what works out. So we don't ever go in our normal levels of being that I've taken care of all my wounds, because we don't know what's around the next corner. And that keeps us humble. And I would say that's true even as we enter into stages of liberation, because there's all of these things that are released at different levels. There's aspects of selfing that get released all the way up at the last one at the Arahant level, that it would work that way, just in a logical way. So when we talk about this moving through our clinging and our wanting moving to being more and more free, it's a little bit confusing around wanting to be able to be neutral, to not be caught around anything, and yet something seems as though it'd be natural that they have preference over another. So the preference, for instance, I much prefer that each of you be healthy than not be healthy. I have a preference. There is desire around that preference. Do you not have that for yourself, not for those you love? So then where does this teaching about not valuing one thing over another fit in to this? How is it that that works, that's true too about that we want to have a kind of equanimity around experience? So on a more reflected, more examined level, how might that work? as I wrote about extensively in Dancing with Life, my teacher, the Venerable Sumedho, speaks of desire as the natural energy of this realm, and that desire itself is not the problem, but our relationship to desire, where we identify with that desire and we create a self and we cling to it and we build a whole structure in our head. And that very much applies to this. So yes, you want those that you're close to be healthy. And in your bigger moments, you want all human beings to not have to suffer the illnesses and painful kinds of health experiences of all kinds. And yet, we know in this acceptance of the way the world is that old age, sickness, and death, that they, whether it's broken bones or infections or whatever it may be, are part of this realm. And so we hold in the relative way this preference of one or the other, one versus the other. We prefer health over non-health. My godson, I was on the phone with him today, he's on crutches, and his girlfriend has just had this terrible infection. And so they're taking turns taking care of each other, but it's been a rough couple of weeks as they're going through this. And I asked him, I said, so what effect has that been on the two of you in your feeling close to one another? And it was a different subject. And he thought for a moment, he said, actually, it's brought us closer because we've taken turns just in a beautiful way of taking care of each other. It's been her turn or then my turn, and it's really been beautiful. And we've not known this before, and neither of us had ever had any health issues. So this is kind of our first experience of health issue. And we're each having it individually, but we're getting to have it together. And so in that way, you would certainly prefer, they would both prefer not to have the health issue they have. But in accepting it, to not have it as a demand, so maybe thinking of it not so much as preference alone, but demand, this contracting into that I don't want to be healthy, not feeling unhealthy, not feeling sorry for themselves, and therefore being open to what was the greater experience around something they did not prefer. They gained something that they might not gain for a long time otherwise in the way of intimacy. Do you see? And so it's not deeming anything unacceptable. I have a preference for each of you, but I don't deem that life is unacceptable because those preferences aren't met. And the same is true for myself. I have preferences for myself, but I don't deem life unacceptable because those preferences aren't met. I don't believe that if this preference that's arising right now is met, I'm going to be happy forever. In the chain of dependent origination, there's contact and this whole bloodstream of contact and this whole series of events that happens. That would start this chain of dependent origination, starting with ignorance. We believe what we desire right now. Well, if I just have this, I'll be happy. And by that we mean happy forever. And there's a generalization of it in the mind that's unrecognized that leads to this clinging. And there's one thing after another, and we're forever in this cycle of clinging, wanting this, wanting that. And so, the learning to not fall into that trap and see more clearly that yes, this will be better, but I can't base my life on wanting preferences because it does not pay off. There's always another preference and another preference. The Nietzsche nature of life makes that an unsound strategy for well-being. And so the lack of the wanting, not wanting preference is at this subtle level of attachment, not in this moment of like of not wanting what would be healthier, what would be kind, and so forth. So that's the level that it happens. And the deathless, reaching the deathless, which this, you know, this island that you cannot go beyond, this the deathless understood as that which has not been born, not created, not born, and not subject to dying, is the knowing, this awareness that is not bound to this plane. And a Buddha that has achieved the levelhood of arhat, we don't have to call them a Buddha, just call them an arhat, the way it is taught that the arhat, as long as they have a body, has to live out the karma of a body. An arhat has ceased to create new karma, but the karma is still being lived out as long as you have a body, and it is only when you let loose of the body that all of the past karma is expiated at the arhat level. Otherwise, you're still in the remnants, as it were, of being born in this realm. And this realm has karma attached to it. The body has to have old age, sickness, and death. It's the nature of this realm as we know it. And so the sense of what the deathless is not of this realm. It is of another realm. It is another. It is beingness and a non-attaching way, and that can occur in this realm. That one, and I truly believe this is possible, that one can be an arahant in this realm when one is no longer caught by the arisings in this realm at all. And in that sense, there is no preferences anymore. But that is at a stage that is beyond when we as ordinary practitioners are going to be. So we don't want to think we're supposed to be having no preference in that way when the liberation has occurred at a much deeper, more subtle level than our earnest aspiring to be non-attached. So we let loose right now of what's where we're feeling detachment, rather than saying I'm going to be a person of no preference. You know, that could actually be leading to a rigidity that would make it harder to let go. Can I let go of what's in front of me? What is the demand right now? Do I have to take birth in this demand? Oh, this room's too hot. This room's too hot. And we realize it's not just that it feels uncomfortable for us. It is being deemed unacceptable that this room is this temperature. Can we let loose of that? Or if this room's too cold, or this person's making too much noise, or my stomach's upset yet again, and there's this demand that my stomach not be upset. It shouldn't be upset. We would certainly prefer, out of kindness, that the stomach not be upset. But the nature of stomachs is that they are liable to be upset. And so we let loose of that second arrow. It's bad enough that we have an upset stomach, but our demand that it be otherwise, this clinging for having sense experiences, the first kind of the second noble truth, tanha, clinging, thirsting, that we let loose of it. And so as we let loose of more and more in that way, we meet life in its unevenness with more and more ease. It's again that we don't have to get rid of every preference, but we're not being defined by our preferences. It's the characteristic. We do what we can to bring ease to ourselves and others in our lives, but we don't demand that. Our sense of well-being becomes more and more free of conditions in that way. And so therefore preferences become less important in a very real way, this is not some theoretical. You can feel it in your own life. Many of you have sat plenty of enough in here to know the truth of this for yourself. You are less bound by your preferences. You're much more able to roll with, not be caught when things don't go your way, when there's upset, whether it's physical or mental or conditions around you or the condition of the world. You become more at ease with the way things are. That you can feel this for yourself. So as we start to understand where we are in this great long chain of practice, the gradual path, we come to see that rather than responding to ourselves and our shortcomings with harshness, we start to see that there is a kind of kindness that is actually more appropriate as a response to our circumstances. Yesterday, during the Care Providers Day, in my new format, I got to answer questions. In the past, I didn't do that. I deferred to the teachers who were helping me, and so I was free to take questions. And a number of questions came up about the difficulty of either the person that was being taken care of about their endless demands, including like, why would you even think of taking a day off from taking care of me, and how that was, you know, that really felt like such a tyrant, and to the person's own feelings about themselves and their inadequacies. And in both instances, my response was kindness. Be kind to that part of you that's resentful. Don't be mad at that part. Don't judge the part that's resentful that you're having to play this role with a loved one. Be kind to the part that's resentful and thank them for participating and taking care of the person you're taking care of, so that you, rather than falling into just judging and comparing or trying to fix ourselves, we first meet what's true with a kind attitude. That requires equanimity, because without the equanimity, we get overwhelmed. So that's why we're developing not just kindness and compassion, but we're developing equanimity. Metta and upekkha are the underlying forces that support each other. This natural kindness of the heart, this radiating kindness of the heart, and this upekkha, this willingness to see things the way they are and accept the way they are, not have a preference that catches us, allows us to do this. And so kindness is wise practice, and it certainly makes life feel better. If kindness is not indulgence, it's not indulgence. We're going to indulge a certain amount anyway, but the kindness is not like, oh, you're perfect no matter what you do, and it's just, oh, since this is all relative anyway, the fact that you're being a jerk in some way at this moment, it doesn't really matter. It's just a moment anyway. That is not the teaching. In fact, the teaching is just the opposite, that we are accountable and we're kind. There's a song that I can't remember. Maybe I heard it in a movie or something. I don't know why I would have heard it otherwise. But there's a line in it that's called, "It's funny how falling feels like flying for a while." And that's what it feels like when we give in to our judging self, whether we're judging ourselves or other, or when we're feeling wronged or we're indignant about the world. That anger feels like flying for a while because it's so justified, and you're getting that adrenal rush and all this, so you're flying. But we fall because there's a delusional aspect to this. This harsh judging of the world, making the other less, a mosquito or something. Wow. A little buzz that in my ear. There he is. This harsh judging of the world is narrowing us. It doesn't mean that we don't have preference in terms of how our country is run or how our community would respond to a need within the community, or how we would, when we're in the emergency room, we would have a preference about how we would be treated and the preference would be based on the values that we hold and then ideally that we're part of a community that holds those same values. And so in the same way, when we're holding ourselves accountable in the way we would hold others accountable. And that, but again, we would not want to be judging ourselves, but discerning what's skillful and unskillful. What is a wholesome goal of the way you're treating someone, or an unwholesome goal? If you're wanting something that's exploiting another, or someone's wanting to exploit you, that's an unwholesome goal. That's unwholesome. And so unwholesome goals bring unwholesome results for everybody involved, whereas wholesome goals can bring good results for everyone involved if we employ skillful means to achieve those goals. So there's a double requirement for living life in a wholesome way. One is the goals be wholesome, and the other that the means be wholesome. Not in the sense of being perfect. We're moving in a direction. We're not saying we can control to be perfect, because that thing goes back that we know what is perfect, and we can judge ourselves, or we can judge others, or we can compare ourselves or compare others, or both. And so we're learning to let loose of that kind of rigid thinking. That's why it is a gradual path of development, because we're not like, okay, in this moment I'm supposed to be perfect. In this moment, the aspiration, the goal, is to show up as best we're able. And we have integrity around as best we're able, as best I am able. That is what allows the individual development to be occurring, because we're holding ourselves accountable from to the point that we are able. That sometimes we discover that we have not actually done that, that we didn't really show up for ourselves in this way. So that was turned out to be what was the truth. Couldn't do this better. Other times we look backwards, or even in the middle, we realize that we know we're not meeting our level of integrity, and we still don't. At least I do that sometimes. I feel myself not meeting what I'm capable of doing in this moment for reasons that I sometimes know and sometimes I don't know. Other times we have actually had great integrity in our effort, but what was called for was more than we could do. You've known that, right? That is in this Buddhist term, samprajana, that it's wise understanding and clear comprehension. And clear comprehension, prajana with wisdom, with the first four of the four tenets of clear comprehension is knowing what's called for and knowing what's suitable for you to do. So this much may be been called for, you know, if we're putting in horizontal effort, it's 3 yards of effort, but we're only capable of, 9 inches of effort. We can't do our 9 units of effort versus 36 units of effort, if you want to see it, that we can only do what we can do at this point in time, whether it's subjective or objective effort. We can only do what we can do. And knowing what we can do and responding with what we can do actually turns out to be more effective than trying to do more than we can do, because that often means that we actually don't get done what we could do. So there's a level that you can be kind to someone that's being difficult that you can do, but if you try to do more than that, you end up getting really irritated with them, and you fail yourself. So finding the integrity is of our relationship, of our values, of our aspiration towards freedom, to cause non-suffering, that aspiration, meets conditions in time. And there's an approximation there that, yes, we know if we were fully liberated that would be like this, but we're not fully liberated, so it's more modest what we do. But if there's integrity, each time we're planting the seeds to be able to do more in the future time. So the integrity becomes important. And the sticky part of that is that the more you know, the more challenging the integrity, because you know what you're capable of and you know what's being called for. So there's as clear comprehension grows as a development, as a individual development, we are called for the integrity would have us measure against what we're capable of in a way that would mean less preference from our subjective reactive mind states and more from the responsive mind state that represents our values. In a reactive mind state, we are identified with, we are controlled, we're defined by those things that are causing us to cling. There's not freedom in a reactive mind state. It's either based on its vedana, the unpleasantness of it, or pleasantness if it's unpleasant, we want to get rid of it. If it's pleasant, we want to justify having it and getting more of it and keeping what we have. That's the untrained minds. That's why vedana is so powerful, this feeling tone of pleasant and unpleasant, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And so as we grow, we become more and more interested in the integrity of this experience. Am I aligned with what I'm capable of doing right now? Or have I given up? Am I indulging? Or am I overzealous so that I'm berating myself for not doing what I'm not capable of doing? So I'm not in the balance place that will allow me to grow. Are you tracking this? This balance place. As we grow in this manner, we more and more let loose of this imagined self that we are, and we are more and more responding to just what we're capable of right now, where we don't, this structured self, this conceptualized self, is less and less in the way. And we're more and more in the moment of what we're with. We have, again, knowing our goal, and we're more and more learning what we're capable of. And we've seen the wisdom. We've received the fruit of this. And so this whole idea about me, you know, I'm this and I'm that, we're not so interested in that. Right now, am I causing suffering or not? If I'm causing suffering, it may feel like flying, but it's only for a little while. We know that. We know the truth of that for ourselves. We're not believing anybody. We know the truth of this for ourselves. And therefore, we're able to meet this moment. We can arise to this occasion. We learn to recognize demand as a signal. Why am I demanding? One place I have trouble is because all my adult life, I've flown so much, particularly during the first 20 years of my adult life. I was flying in 1 year 200,000 miles and just crazy. This was all, unfortunately, before loyalty miles and all this. Otherwise, I'd be flying forever for free, or certainly first class and all that. But anyway, because I've spent so many hours on airplanes, I have a kind of self-justified resentment of the way the airlines maximize their profit rather than maximize being able to be on time and not inconvenience. And there's values difference. What would be the sweet spot between airlines maximizing their profit but still taking care of their customers? There would be a sweet spot, because there's some degree that I and all customers have to be inconvenienced so they can make a profit, so they can stay in business. I don't think this is where we are in that process, but my indignation about it is my problem. That is my getting so self-righteous. My I mean, this feeling of demand, which I will get flushed with it, you know. That's my suffering. It doesn't, nobody, the airline is not suffering. I'm suffering. And it is my delusion. It is my delusion. I am holding on to preference that the way I think it should be, that serves no end, whatsoever, and it is causing suffering. I know this, so it's a point of practice. Sometimes on some trips I do very well. Sometimes I watch them set up all of this going wrong so far in advance, and I can't tell anybody, no, there's a better way right now. This is such a better decision. Don't do this. Consolidate these flights right now. Don't wait 2 hours to consolidate these flights. Let's do it right now. And I get to wanting my preference. It's unpleasant, but there's no reason for me to get indignant. When I am like that, I know I am not measuring to the integrity of the level of what I know. I know that that in terms of the capacity, as best I am able, is more than what I'm able to manifest. If I'm honest with that in the moment, then it can be a point of practice in this moment. If I'm not honest and I'm totally swept away by my indignation about this, then this is not a practice moment. This is just another moment of delusion, and with it all the suffering. This can be true for you at the doctor's offices, or it can be true for you in the supermarket or with your family, where you get carried away. The conditioned realm is the conditioned realm. The liberation is not that the conditioned realm gets fixed, but that we develop a new relationship with the conditioned realm. When that relationship is free of a reactive mind, then we are in the neighborhood of the deathless. Step by step, the gradual path, individual development, letting loose, meeting our shortcomings with kindness while holding ourselves accountable. And this is the way that we move towards the deathless. So thank you for your attention with this. I didn't conceive of it as having questions afterwards till just this very moment. Shoot. There's a little preference. Okay, so let's sit together, and I will have the meta cards read in a moment. I'll call for them. And if there are two that are saying the same thing, just read them once. So we don't read it. We don't repeat the same meta wish twice. Please. So just a moment of reflection. First reflection about demand, the feeling of demand. Like, do you have some sense of what that means for you? About this demanding nature, this demanding attitude that can crop up. And what it would be to recognize it and saying, can I let loose of this? Do you have a feel for it enough to practice with it? Last week, a number of people came up afterwards and were talking about how they recognized the demand and they could work with it. What about for you? Maybe that word does not resonate, but the energy of it does. Maybe preference, this demanding preference, might be a better phrase than just the word demand for at least one person in the room. This is how we kind of come to what we're going to think about in terms of practice walking around practice, mindfulness walking around in our lives. So demand is one we can notice. Another one is this idea that I've introduced of integrity. I have found it very useful. Am I integrity with what I know and what I'm capable of? So it's one thing to know, and it's another to develop the capability. The integrity first comes from, okay, I know this, now I've got to develop the capability. Am I aligned with developing what I know to be true that would bring less suffering? Am I aligned with that or not? In a given area of my life, with a given person, with a given kind of situation. And then secondly, when we develop the capability, am I in integrity in this moment? Am I doing as best I am able in this moment? And as best I am able can vary dramatically. Sometimes, even though we know and we develop the capability, there's only a smidge of capability present. Other times it's moderate, other times it's strong, other times it's huge amount of capability. So the integrity, this it has this stay accountable for what is best I am able feels like. If you don't understand this, this is one thing to ask me. I consider it one of the key understandings that has helped me in life, is this as best I am able. The integrity is like, I have not talked much about that, but it's, until recently, but it's really worth your knowing for yourself. So the second reflection, one is demand, two is integrity, and then the three is this as best I am able. Do you live with this commitment of as best I am able? If you do, you are in integrity. When we're in integrity, there's a coherence to our sense of the moment-to-moment beingness of life. So knowing these reflections, you take them with you into this week. And now for this moment, you just drop into this moment. Just now, no doing, just being. Here, just being here, just being now. Stillness of the body, stillness of the mind not moving to the objects that arise and pass through it. You're just being. Just be.